national championship than a Tarkenton Award.
Any player would.
Any player would. Okay, let's be honest there. How the team does is much more important than how she does it individually. Okay, everybody wants the chip. But still, for the program and for the university, finally getting that to Wharton is just as much breaking glass ceiling as it is getting to the Final Four.
It's close. It's close to comparable.
Yeah, as a team, though, you still want to get to the Final Four. And if they ignore her completely and she gets to the Final Four, she'll be happy.
Yeah. I mean, athletics would obviously run with that. You use it for recruiting, you know, stuff of that sort. You know, you get to say that, hey, listen, you come here, you can be a Tarkenton winner. You know, we've done it before, we can do it again.
Yeah. And not only that, you can be a player that, you know, might be overlooked a little bit because of, you know, not fitting the mold, so to speak. You know, maybe a little undersized or a little this, a little that, and you play for Joe Spallina, and all those little disadvantages become strengths. Because we see Ellie in action, and I've said it before many times, is that, you know, I she plays the game like she's on skates.
Yeah.
And I mean that in the absolutely highest compliment I could pay because of the way, first of all, the smoothness, the agility, the running around people like pylons, all of it's there. And her skill is just a level above the people she faces. So, yes, huge fans of Ellie Masseri. Huge fans of the team in general. But I pointed this out a couple weeks ago. Joe Spallina put up a video of his son Joey with an over-the-shoulder goal for Syracuse, finding the upper corner of the net. And I'm like, this looks like what Ellie did 2 weeks ago.
She's done it a few times.
Yeah. But that video was circulating on social media, too. And my comment was, Ellie continues to be a good influence. I like it.
Yeah. Well, Matt, do you want to do some baseball talk now, even okay. though we don't have George?
10 o'clock, top of the hour, sports section. Matt Mankiewicz, Kevin Broderick here until midnight. You want to join in the conversation, 631-632-9872. And the lacrosse conversation, we want to resume it, and you want to voice your concerns, go right ahead. But also, we did have some other interesting activity going on this weekend because everybody except for men's lacrosse was home. So you had women's lacrosse playing at Laval Stadium. You had softball playing at University Field. And most importantly, right now, you have baseball playing at Joe Nathan Field, doing what they needed to do, and that is to maintain pace in the CAA by sweeping a team that is at the bottom of the CAA. In other words, beating teams you should beat, making hay while the sun shines, like I always like to say. And that's becoming a tagline for me, but nowhere is it more true than with Stony Brook baseball's schedule and the fact that they've won 8 of 9 since getting swept by Charleston in conference. So your net result is a 9-6 record. Right now they're in the 4. If the season ended today, they're 20-17 overall. They're above 500 overall too. William and Mary in Delaware are behind them by a game. Campbell's down 2, and Elon and the rest further back. But at 9-6, they're only a game behind Northeastern now, and 2 behind but Charleston and UNCW. Oh, 3, correction. 3 behind Charleston and UNCW for the top seed. And you look at their schedule, and before we even go into what they did this weekend on the field, I'm just looking at what's coming up for them. And you go to Monmouth next weekend. You got Hofstra at home, who's below you in the standings. You got Delaware at home, who's below you in the standings. And you got Northeastern to finish out the season on the road, who's above you in the standings. So I do believe it's a golden opportunity to not only lock down a playoff spot, but a good seed as well. Because these are teams, one, you don't have to face a lot of the teams you're at least as good as, and you're facing a lot of teams you're better than down the stretch. Okay, with all that said, taking a look, and I'll open it up because on Friday, things began for the Seawolves. And, yeah, I will set it up because, yes, today's game, I was able to broadcast Saturday and Sunday. But the most important thing here is the sweep began on Friday, and with a victory against the Towson Tigers, a 4-2 win. And that was helped by Eddie Smink with a solid start. And not only that, Eric Paulson finishing with a three-inning save. So keep that in mind. Used one reliever on Friday. Didn't have to use him again the whole weekend. Although you did have him warming up in the bullpen late today. So, solid start there. Then we go to Saturday. And as I pull up Saturday here, this was a crazy one. Because two things happened here. One, you had Nick Rizzo get tagged for a bunch of runs early on, by five runs. So what happens? Okay, you open up the box score, and he goes 2+ and gets himself into a little bit of trouble. But right behind him, Colin Ryan. Now, Colin Ryan had a nice start against Iona, went 8 3rd innings, but it's Iona, right? He's been used in relief most of the time, you know, occasional midweek starter. But he stays in the game and goes 8. Gives up 2 runs on 4 hits and keeps the Seawolves in the game. The Seawolves start chipping away, and yes, we know why Towson is at the bottom of the CAA, simply because their pitchers can't find the plate. Instead, in the 7th inning alone, they hit 3 guys in a row. That tells you everything you need to know right there. Lack of control. And the Seawolves were able to capitalize. So, end up tying the game. And then, in the 10th inning, I'm going to pull up my scorecard here. They tied the game in the 9th. Not able to get the winning run across, even though it was only 90 feet away. So, Evan Fox singles. Matt Maselli sacrifices him over. Matt Brown-Aaron gets hit by a pitch. Okay. Matt Brown-Aaron singles and gets him over to third. He steals second, so runners on second and third. Eric Paulson strikes out. Johnny Pill is up. And the winning run scores on a balk. So, the Seawolves pull out that one. Now we go to Sunday. Okay, remember, you've only used 2 guys out of the bullpen already. So JT Rabb comes in to pitch on Sunday and goes all the way. Now, the one thing when a pitcher goes deep into a game, particularly at the major league level, let's say they go to the 7th or 8th inning and their pitch count isn't too high, oftentimes, if they get through the inning unscathed, they'll just let him keep going, but gives up so much as a hit or a walk, puts a guy on, he's gone. That doesn't work with Matt Sank. No, because now you're opening up the book again. He retires. Well, after giving a walk up to Brian Heckelman, the catcher in the 8th spot in the 6th inning, he... Okay, that is... Sorry, correction on that. That's yesterday. That was actually Ryan's performance. So let's go to today's performance here. So, 1-2-3-8. Okay, his pitch count isn't particularly high. He's averaging about 11 or 12 pitches per inning, which is excellent. So, what happened was, in order to add some runs, Chris Carson gets pinch hit by Evan Goforth. Okay, so Goforth grounds into a fielder's choice, ends the 7th inning. But he has to go back out in the field. So in the 9th, pop up on the left side of the field, Goforth drops it, E5. Okay, Tay Robinson flies out, and the error results in 3 bases. So because Cole Stefano, with a RBI ground out, makes the game 4-3. Now, you pull him? You pull JT Rabb, gives up a hit to Chris Akers. Do you pull him now? No. That's the difference between Matt Sink and a lot of coaches that would go by the book. Kept Rabb in the game. Had guys up in the bullpen. He had Eric Paulson up in the bullpen, ready to go, just in case. Gets a flyout, and that's it. And it's a complete game. And I just brought back memories of guys like Brandon McNitt, Frankie Vanderka, and a whole bunch of other great Stony Brook pitchers who came up with big, complete game wins when they were needed. And JT Rabb made an impression. Very efficient game. Now, yes, it's Towson. It's not a very good team, but I don't care. You go all the way in the CAA against any team in the CAA, you've done something. And that's what impressed me about the pitching. Stony Brook didn't have, not only number one, didn't have to go deep in their bullpen, but number two found something. They found a guy who could go long in Colin Ryan. Now, Ryan may have trouble against the College of Charleston, let's say in the CAA playoffs, but that's in the back of your head now, because in the playoffs, in the double elimination, you may need more than three starters. You may need a fourth guy. You may need a fifth guy. You may need three innings out of one of your better relievers who is a designated hitter otherwise. You may need all these things. Now, of course, there are other things we need to talk about too, in particular the defense. The defense has been good with the lineup that Matt Sink has been running out, but now you know why Goforth is not playing third base. Made a crucial error, which was compensated for, fortunately. The Seawolves had a two-run lead, but a run was given up, and that's something you do not want to see happen in against a Northeastern or in the playoffs against anybody. But think about it this way. It's coming together. Oh, by the way, dimension. Talking about home runs. Talking about where people stand in the CAA, where people stand in, just want to double check Friday, because Friday, want to make sure that, because we didn't broadcast that game, want to make sure, I got to go back to the news here, and we got to regenerate the page. In that game, whether or not anybody hit a home run on the Seawolves side, and the answer to that is nobody. The Seawolves did not hit a single home run all weekend. Got some singles, got some doubles, got hit by pitches, got walks. This is a team that's not going to overwhelm you offensively. But they did manage to score 8 runs when they needed to and got great pitching in the other two games. Again, it's Towson, last place team in the conference. I know. But I just went through the schedule. I just went through the stretch run for this team. And you want to know something? They're going to be facing a bunch of other teams like that. Now, will they drop a couple? Look, I don't expect them to win 8 of the next 9. But it's possible because, like I said, 3 in Monmouth, 3 home against Hofstra, 3 home against Delaware, 3 at Northeastern. Now, of course, there are a couple of midweek games that we're not overly concerned with. They will be going bad again. However, no, I should definitely walk that back because Manhattan is a midweek game that's going to be this Tuesday. You're going to get Fairfield on the road next Tuesday. You're going to get Sacred Heart on the road the Tuesday after that. And that's your non-conference schedule sewed up. But what other things are you going to discover in those midweek games? Because like I said, Colin Ryan had a turnaround to his year against Iona. And ended up turning a solid performance against Towson. And yes, last place team. But again, look at those CAA standings. And it's a confidence boost as well. That's the most important thing, is that The Seawolves have been vaulted into not only a playoff spot, but a solid playoff spot. And a playoff spot that now becomes theirs to lose. Because if they hold serve, they're going to lock it down. They're only a game out of the three and three out of the top. Charleston and UNC Wilmington are tied at 12-3. And when you look at those teams that are ahead of them, Stony Brook goes head to head against Northeastern to end the regular season. But Northeastern lost a game to Towson first weekend in April. Okay, took 2 out of 3 against Delaware, dropped 2 out of 3 to UNC Wilmington. They get Elon next, North Carolina A&T. They got Charleston. So they got UNCW, they've got Charleston, who are the teams ahead of them, and Stony Brook, that's a team one game behind them. Northeastern doesn't have it easy. Stony Brook could overtake Northeastern by the time they get to head-to-head. What's ahead for UNC Wilmington? Okay. They've got William & Mary on the road. They got Campbell at home. And Campbell is, you know, they're not out of it yet. They're only a couple of games behind Stony Brook. They've got Hofstra at home, and then they go to Delaware. So they're not so bad for them. William & Mary, a game behind Stony Brook at 8-7. They took 2 out of 3 against them back in March. Don't think they'd do it again. Took 2 out of 3 from Monmouth. Took 2 out of 3 from A&T. Got swept by Charleston. And they will, this weekend, that's why Charleston's where they are. They got UNC Wilmington, Elon, Towson, and Campbell again. So the scenario for Stony Brook is very, very good at this point. They're playing a bunch of teams that are equal to them, but they're also playing a bunch of teams they're better than. So I like their chances. I like how this team is starting to gel. I like – now, will they be able to take on – I think they're in a much better position to take on Charleston and UNC Wilmington, Northeastern, the teams ahead of them in the tournament right now than they've ever been. But all they have to do now is hold serve, and they're going to be in a pretty good position. Okay, so the baseball team is in very good shape right now, and the things that we were hoping to see, this is a team that is very resourceful. I like to say Matt Sink this and Matt Sink that. A Matt Sink performance, a Matt Sink pitching performance, which you got from JT Rabb. Some Matt Sink hits, which are line drives in the gap, because Joe Nathan Field is built for that. Matt Sink fundamentals, taking extra bases, you know, playing heads up ball as a general rule. And even when you make a mistake, you know, you're trying to do something more. It's an honest mistake, if you want to call it that. And yes, there were a couple made in this weekend. That's, you know, part of being human. But I like the resourcefulness of this team. I like it a lot better than last year. And that gives me confidence. And that means we might be able to see good things come out of this team. Now, that said, what was going on directly behind us over the weekend with the softball team is absolutely stupendous. Because they have run their winning streak to 16 in a row. They are 15-6 in conference as a result. They are 29-13 overall. And they are knocking on the door of the top teams. And they've locked down a playoff spot, most importantly of all. They're still in third place because Campbell is 16-5 and Delaware is 18-3. But here's another team, okay, that whose pitching is not as good as it was 2 years ago. And yet, they're finding ways. And they stomped on Drexel. They swept them, and you know they invoked the mercy rule yesterday with a 10-1 win in 5 innings. They pull out a walk-off win in 9 today. So Drexel came close to ending that streak. But again, great position for them. Okay, So let's review a little bit, because the softball team right now, as great as women's lacrosse has been, they're the headline after winning 16 in a row and vaulting themselves into the top three in the CAA. You have to be extremely happy, number one, with the performance, and you were especially happy with the fact that they're doing it with the same kind of grit and resourcefulness that baseball's doing. Because we shall go back a little bit to this past weekend and begin, of course, with moving down the schedule with Drexel. 4-0 win on Friday. And at that time, the 14th straight win. Mia Haynes, complete game shutout, her fourth this season. And C.A. Kapinski, 3-run homer. And there you go. Haynes went the distance, gave up 4 hits, walked 2, struck out 4 in a complete game effort, stranded 7 Drexel runners, left runners in scoring position in 2 separate innings. So Kapinski's 3-run homer turns out to be the game. They go to the next day, and they absolutely stomp on Drexel. They went go win 10-1 in 5 innings. Gabrielle Mayday picks up her 10th victory with ease. Why? Because the Seawolves answered with 3 runs in the home half of the first. Alicia Roscoe, Kira McFarland worked walks. They scored after a fielding error at second and a double play later in the frame. Naja Ackerman played the 3rd run with an opposite field single. They also ended up tacking on a bunch in the second inning where they scored 7. So basically they had to go through the motions because Drexel was not able to plate another run after scoring the top of the first. They end it in 5. Then we go to today. And this game, all 3 of these games were going on while the baseball games were going on. So all I do is look over my shoulder to check out the action and check the scores. But today was a little bit more difficult because in this case, Drexel got on the board first again. Stony Brook answered in the 3rd. Stony Brook had a 5-run 4th, but they ended up giving up 4 in the 5th and then another in the 6th. And that game carried on until the 9th when they were finally able to get the walk-off win. And Ashton Milos got the win out of the bullpen. She's tossed 4 shutout innings, gave up 2 hits, no walks, striking out 6. Alyssa Costello went 3-for-4 with a double and a run bat in. Alicia Roscoe went 2-for-5 with an RBI. C.A. Kapinski, who had a hit, a walk, and an RBI. And then Drexel rallied to tie it, and that's where it stayed until the 9th. And it was a fielding error off the bat of Emily Reinstein that got Corinne Badger to score. So, second consecutive season in the CAA, they will be in the postseason. The program record is now 16 with the 16-game winning streak, second longest active streak in all of Division I. 12 straight wins against a conference opponent is the 4th longest active streak in the nation. And the Seawolves, most importantly, they've outscored the opposition during those 16 games 100-25. And here I am saying the pitching is not as dominant as it was 2 years ago. It's still damn good enough. Okay. Kira McFarland, 18-game hitting streak. Catherine Kapinski, 16 straight for her. And Juliana Sanzone, 14-game hitting streak. And Corinne Badger, 12-game hitting streak. So they're clicking. So we've rounded out everything here with the spring sports.
Yep.
Except for one thing.
Oh.
We have a new women's basketball coach.
Oh, yeah. I forgot that happened this week. Oh, my God. There's been so much happening just in terms of sports this week that was put on the back burner a little bit.
Yeah, they snuck that in.
Yeah, I was planning, Matt, on having something a little bit more elegant prepared for this segment. But I guess I'm just going to have to go off what I've already researched so far. And that is, admittedly, very baseline research. It's not anything too outstanding. Just reading a couple of articles and all the times, all the different places she's gotten hired from. So
Troy McCorvey is her name.
Yes.
And she has a Stony Brook connection because she played at St. John's for Kim Barnes-Errico, if I recall correctly off this.
Yes.
And Kim Barnes-Errico is a Stony Brook alum herself. She is now at Michigan.
Yes. So the timeline that I put together is she started as a player at St. John's, then spent 2 years as an assistant there, moved with who you just mentioned to the University of Michigan, stayed there for 7 seasons, continued her coaching career at Florida State University as a rising assistant, got a few larger opportunities at FSU as well, then went over to the University of Tennessee where she continued to shine there, and now has finally come over to Stony Brook for her first head coach gig. So
what nice I've, resume, don't you think?
Yeah, what I've seen so far in
Big
what
Ten
I've,
SEC, how can you go wrong?
Yeah,
no, Tennessee.
She spent a lot of time, and so what I've seen throughout the common trend of the way everyone is describing her is she's a coach that likes to specialize in the post. She likes really getting a lot of reps. What I assume is she's going to continue as a head coach that organizes her offense through the post. And I mean, hey, Shreece Pittman is a great building piece for that. Obviously, you still probably have to bring in another center to fill in the shoes of Kari Clark. But listen, Shreece Pittman, like I just said, is a great, great like starting point for that, because you have Shreece Pittman, you fill in another player like Kari Clark and a coach like her, she might be able to do a little bit more with those two players than Ashley Langford did. And additionally, she's been credited a lot by her former schools of being a great recruiter. So as a great recruiter, you should be able to make the players that you already have here stay, plus bring in a few others in the transfer portal.
That is one thing we were concerned about when Ashley Langford left.
Yeah.
How many players would go with her?
Yeah.
And, yes, she took the job at Tulane, where she is an alum herself, and they welcomed her back with open arms. I saw all the Tulane response to that, welcome home kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of a reminder that, you know, I mean, for example, going way, way back, you know, everybody knows about Lars Tiffany at UVA, but Lars Tiffany left Stony Brook to go back to his alma mater, Brown. So, yeah. You know, people do have roots in other places, and you know, good luck to Ashley Langford. But this, when you look at the resume, and that tells you something else about the job,
yeah,
and what Ashley Langford and her predecessors have been able to make it. That tells you the Stony Brook job has become
sought
aspirational.
Yep.
Yes.
As a top-tier stepping stone, which is, unironically, which is what you want it to be, because eventually, if you get enough coaches that move in and then eventually move out but continue to upgrade the program with every single coach, well, then eventually you have a very, very legitimate team.
Right. And Ashley Langford did do that. And this is a team that's had success in the past, and she took it to another level.
Yeah. I mean, again, not claiming that CAA championship is really what led me to believe that she was going to stay for an extra year, but the fact that she leaves after that means that now McCovery coming in, that is her goal.
Well, that's one thing, but the reason why we felt that Ashley Langford would stick around for another year is because it took an NCAA tournament bid for Steve Peichel to leave.
Yeah.
That's the precedent, so to speak. And Peichel had gotten to the final and got beaten by Vermont and Albany several times prior to that. So we figured, well, the only way he's going to move up is if he gets Stony Brook in the NCAA.
Mm-hmm.
Within minutes, he was at Rutgers. But given that, that game back in 2016 was very much in doubt. Jameel Warney basically pulled the team on his shoulders and carried them to victory with 43 points. So, I mean, that took a miracle.
Yeah.
But Steve Peichel did what you expect a mid-major coach to do, move up. He was an assistant at GW, became a head coach at Stony Brook, got Stony Brook where Stony Brook needed to go, and then moved on. Now, he has struggles at Rutgers, sure, but he's laughing all the way to the bank because his salary went up by a factor of 5. But, and also, his ticket's punched. So, no matter what he does at Rutgers, his next job will probably be pretty good, too. Most importantly, however, is that now you're Sean Helbrin and you say, I have a job that is desirable, not his own job. His own job, yes, becomes more desirable the more Stony Brook succeeds. But my coaching jobs are more desirable. People are lining up to take them. I don't have to go and, you know, look for the assistant to an assistant to an assistant to take this job, please. No. Stony Brook has become a place where people want to go.
Where the next hot rising assistant wants to, you know, get their career off the ground. Because, again, this is a ground four coaching level that's still going to draw attention, proven by the coaches that have already played or that have already coached for Stony Brook. So it's a good program, which is exactly where you want to be.
And the other thing, too, even the longtime coaches here, I'm talking about Matt Sank and Megan Bryant and also Joe Spallina, the longtime coaches here have had success as well. So you're coming into Billy Koch at football with football and, you know, and all the recent coaching hires. It makes the job easier as an athletic director when you have a better pool of people to choose from.
Yeah.
So everything working out nicely. But you know what it also means? And again, going back to what we were talking about just earlier on in the show, what the problem is that if you don't keep pace with the other sports, it becomes a little bit more magnified.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, the further and further that these teams take a step, the more and more you're going to be criticizing the teams that don't. Because if it's not a problem with the athletic director, then it's a problem with the coaches, and then eventually those coaches are going to get replaced.
Well, fact is, we're just talking about it tonight. What is our main subject is that everybody won except men's lacrosse.
Yeah.
Everybody had a great weekend except men's lacrosse.
And that's been the case for a while now where it's, I mean, again, softball on the winning streak like you were talking about, baseball having an impressive season.
They've won 8 of 9 in conference.
Exactly. And
they've dropped one midweek game to Army. That's it.
And of course, you know, we always mention women's lacrosse hasn't lost a conference game in 10 years.
Right.
So it's very easy to point to who the team is, you know, disappointing so far.
And yes, and that's one of the reasons why Jim Nagel was replaced to begin with. Because men's lacrosse, even without Albany, because Albany after Connor Fields has not been Albany, has not been what they were with the Thompsons or with Connor Fields. So, and Joe Spallina's over there saying, hell, I'll coach both programs if they let me.
I would let him.
And he's had success coaching men in the MLL, so Major Lacrosse League. He won with the Long Island Lizards, so you know he's capable of he can coach both sports. Now, again, realistically speaking, you can't have a coach coach two teams.
Why not, Matt? Why not?
His time would be, unless he had a whole bunch of good assistants under him.
No, I know.
Yeah.
I would love to see it. I think that would be hilarious.
Yeah. But, ironically enough, the best men's lacrosse coach in Stony Brook is coaching the women.
Probably. That's the unfortunate thing. Not unfortunate in the sense that I wish he was coaching the men's. I'm glad he's coaching the women's because he's doing great with them, but I think he could do definitely better. I don't know if he would do as good with the women because I think Ellie Massera is definitely a lot, you know, compared to their sports than Dylan Polinetti, but, you know, that's a side point.
Well, there's another thing, too, and because the men's game is more of a contact game, an undersized player, you're essentially asking for a Wayne Gretzky type in a men's lacrosse, and undersized players, yes, they might have more agility, but when they get down low, they get knocked around.
Yeah.
And it is tougher for an undersized player on the men's side to succeed. Meanwhile, you got somebody like Ellie Massera who basically runs rings around everybody.
Yeah. It's a different sport entirely.
Yeah. But that's what they're trying to emphasize, which is one of the reasons why. Remember last year, the Yale player, whose name I miss off the top of my head, who had that major kidney injury on what looked like a very basic stick check, That aroused a lot of controversy on whether or not women's lacrosse is getting too much like the men, meaning much more contact, much more aggressive. And my answer to that is, well, it's going to get like that because the athletes are better.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's more competitive.
Maybe you call it tighter to try to keep it under control, but there's only so much you're going to be able to do.
You got to let them play.
Yeah.
I mean, and that would be a good segue if you're ready to transfer, Matt.
Go for it.
I want to see the referees like the Capitals and the Rangers play. I hate the way the referees are calling this series so far, and it's been one game.
Now, because I wasn't able to watch the Ranger game because I was too busy calling a baseball game, start from the beginning.
All right, so you start off, and it's obvious that the Rangers are the favorites in this series. Anyone who doubts that does not watch hockey. And this is probably going to be the most lopsided series in the entirety of the playoffs, if I'm being completely honest. The Capitals, in my opinion, are by far the worst team. And because of that, I don't know if that's impacting the way the referees are calling this and calling this series, but I want to see them let them play. And this the most specific thing that I'm talking about is Matt Rempe and that very first penalty that was called. And I don't know if you want to look it up, Matt, but
I'm looking for it. Charging 207 of the first.
Yes. So that penalty was extremely confusing because you can literally see Rempe turn his skate to start slowing down when he's going to make that hit. And I honestly think the only reasons the referees called that is so that Rempe knew that he had a short leash for this entire series. And I hate that. I hate that entirely because it's trying to change the player. It's trying to change his game based on a referee's decision that they want to control the series.
Right. Now, if they... Well, that's also focused on one player. And that player, if his game is fundamental, it's one of the reasons why the Rangers are where they are now, because previous years under Gerard Gallant, they're considered a little bit too soft.
Yeah. And, well, this team is anything but soft.
Right.
I think, genuinely, I don't think there is another team in the league right now that has as many fighters as the Rangers and as many skilled fighters as the Rangers.
Because Peter Laviolette knows what it takes to win.
Yeah. No, I mean, again, and I can go down the list. I mean, Rempe will fight, he's not afraid. Trouba will fight, he's not afraid. Cooley will fight, he's not afraid. Goodrow will fight, he's not afraid. VC will fight. Miller has fought, but I don't. That's not really his
game. Now, of course, people don't fight as much in the playoffs, let's be honest. But it also means that their game is not held back either.
Yeah, so... Well, I mean, I guess the biggest point that you have to make about that is that also means they're hitting. And
yes.
The list of Rangers that can just throw the body around and really do a ton of damage to their opponents, it's a lengthy list. I mean, I would tell viewers just go into the Rangers just team biography on hockey stats, hockey data, and just look at the amount of players that are above 6 foot. Look at the amount of players that are 190 pounds or above. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of physical players, and I want to see them lean into that. And if you look at the second goal, the one where Alexis Lafreniere and Vincent Trocheck assisted on, it's exactly what happened. Lafreniere had a huge hit to win possession back, found an open Trocheck who found an open Panarin, and that was the second goal. That was very short after the first goal from Rempe. So, overall, very, very positive about the Rangers right now. I think they're in a great position. I think they're playing the kind of hockey that they need. Their fourth line contributed 2 goals, and I think a combined 5 points between them. And, you know, the first line got going and the second line got going. So, again, the only line from the Rangers so far today that or so far in the playoffs that hasn't contributed a point is the third line. And they have enough skilled players that they'll get there. I mean, Wennberg, Cooley, and Kako, they're not going to score off the wall, but they will score in depth.
Should I remind everybody what the score was? 4-1. So
yeah.
The Rangers won handily, and Rempe even got a goal. So,
I mean, it was a masterclass of everything that you wanted to see. Where, again, and you got to think about that the fact that how young this Rangers team really is.
And even Vezzy got a goal.
Yeah, well, VC.
Yeah, I keep. You know what? I should know that, and I keep muffing it.
That's all good. I mean, he is a bottom line player, but
yeah,
I want to remind everyone how young this Rangers team is, because Kako is very young. Lafreniere is very young.
I have to remind myself, Kako has been around a while, and yeah, we got to remember.
Kako's 22.
That's amazing.
Lafreniere's 21.
Kako's a veteran now. Lafreniere is a veteran now.
I mean, the amount of playoff experience these players have at the beginning of their careers, they've all played. This is now their fifth playoff series,
which is a far cry from where the Rangers were a few years back.
Exactly. This is now their fifth playoff series, and they're gonna get to six. They might get to seven, and might get to eight. Okay. They've been to an Eastern Conference Finals already. And then going down the further list, I mean, look at the players that are under 25. You can throw Fox in there.
Yep.
You can throw Lindgren in there. You can throw Miller in there. You can throw Schneider in there. You can throw Rempe in there. You can throw Cooley in there. I mean, it's a very, very young and yet skilled and tough team. Again, if Laviolette ends up being the coach of the future, which I still hold my reservations on, because Laviolette usually wears out his welcome after a couple of years, just like Gallant does. So you really
and Mike Keenan from way back when.
Exactly. You really got to see. I think Gallant might have staying power depending on how he fits in with the younger guys on this team. But the Rangers are going to be a problem, and they already are. So I don't understand why so many people in the media are saying, like, are not throwing the Rangers in as their top contenders. Maybe it's because they won the President's Trophy and everyone always says that's a curse. Hasn't been the case in Rangers history. The Rangers teams that have won the President's Trophy have been good.
Yeah, oh, no doubt about that. But only 1994,
yeah,
they didn't win the President's Trophy and won the Cup. But 91-92, they did, and that was a disappointing year.
Trying to think, I thought they won the President's Trophy in 94. Did they not?
You may be right, actually. Now I'm thinking about it. But the President's Trophy, as a rule, I think about one third.
Yeah, they won the President's Trophy in 94.
About one third of the teams that have won and have gone on to win the Cup.
And again, you got to think about this from a statistical point. There is one President's Trophy. There are 15 other teams that enter the playoffs.
Right.
So the fact that there's a so-called President's Trophy curse is not that surprising. The only time where I would say it was actually a curse was in the case of the Bruins last year. Because I think the Bruins killed themselves in the regular season pushing for that record-breaking season and ended up not really having the gas in the long run. And the same thing happened in the Lightning up against the Blue Jackets. So in those cases, I do think it's a real thing. But in other cases, not really.
Well, the reason why everybody says the President's Trophy, number one, the record does show it, but the most important thing is what you just said, is that, you know, teams shouldn't chase it.
No.
Is what is the message that's being broadcast to everyone who's listening, is that you don't want to waste your energy in the regular season at the expense of what you're doing in the playoffs. And yes, getting a home ice advantage is great.
You can do that without doing what the Bruins did last year.
Also very true, because they won the President's Trophy by a fairly large margin. So yeah. Rest guys. Don't overwork them. And look,
which is what the Rangers did this season, Matt, if you remember.
Yeah.
If you remember the fact that they had that stretch from Christmas break to All-Star break. All of the games in between there, that's when me and you were questioning if this team was legit. And then they come out of All-Star break and they look like the team that they were in the beginning of the season. And they win the President's Trophy because of that. So they pace themselves.
Yeah, and that's up to the coaching staff to do, because obviously, you know, everybody wants to play. And he's got to, you know, short shift people and move lines around and give people a little bit of a break. And I still remember, again, we're jumping sports here. But I remember one night, the San Antonio Spurs, back when they were good, were facing the Brooklyn Nets, back when they were good. And this is only a couple years ago. So Greg Popovich rested some of his top players because he said, we're on a long road trip and I need these guys to the playoffs. And I don't care what the league tells me that, you know, that you're disappointing the Brooklyn fans by not bringing out your best players. I don't care. Exactly. Greg Popovich, he certainly doesn't care.
He does not care about the entertainment value. No. And he shouldn't. He's
gets paid
coach.
To win.
Exactly. And completely different incentives for him.
Right. And yes, sometimes you do have to pace yourself. And yes, the Nets ended up winning that game. I still remember another one. Knicks Bulls in the Jordan era. And the Bulls were, everybody knows what they were doing at the time. And the Knicks beat them on a Sunday afternoon, which when NBC was the rights holder, was the national game. So they put on a pretty good show. Dennis Rodman says, didn't shoot the ball particularly well. He actually didn't say that. He said we shot the ball like but but he said, to them it's a big win. To us it's 1 of 82.
Yeah. As it should be.
And when the Bulls were having that season, and the season when they went 72-10, yes, the Knicks did pick up one of those wins. But did the Bulls care? No. Because they were won a whole bunch of other games. But the whole point was they needed to be ready for the playoffs. And the playoffs, when those two teams face each other, and this is another perfect example. Remember talking about men's lacrosse when the Thompsons were playing at Albany and they ran to a wall. The Knicks teams back in those days were excellent. The only problem is they had to face the Bulls in the same conference, so they never got to the finals.
And the Bulls were just the better team.
And those playoff series were war. They were the de facto finals because the Bulls would cruise them there. But they had to get past the Knicks. They had to work to get past the Knicks. But it's the same situation here. Okay? What's our primary concern with the New York Rangers? It's not who they would face in the West in the Stanley Cup final. It's who they're facing on the way there.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'm scared about the West. I think this Stanley Cup, more so than last year, I think it's going to be a battle from every single point. And I think over the last couple of years, there's been a legitimate contender from both conferences. I mean, you have the Golden Knights. So I would say that was definitely true with the Tampa teams.
Yes.
I think that the Tampa teams that played up, and I think it's actually a great comparison.
And the Islanders gave them all they could handle.
Exactly. The Tampa teams that beat the Islanders, I mean, again, I don't want to bash Islanders fans when they're down because I know the last 2 years have been tough. But the Islanders were genuinely a couple of wins away from two Stanley Cups.
Yeah.
Because I think the Islanders would have beaten the Canadiens. I think they would have beaten the Stars. I don't think those teams were ready to be in finals, and I think that was partially because of COVID, but also the fact that, the West was weaker. You had the Avalanche that were building into a powerhouse. You had the Knights that were underperforming a little bit and also building into a powerhouse. You had the Stars that were still building, and now you have all of those teams converging at the same time. So I think the West is as much of a dogfight that it is in the East right now.
You know what? Speaking of which, but let's stick with the Rangers for a little bit because that's really your primary concern. Can the Rangers? I think the Rangers will be able to handle Washington no matter how tightly the game is
called.
Should
be a 4-0 sweep. That was my prediction. I think they're sweeping them, and I think the playoffs for the Rangers really start second round.
Yeah. So, I mean, Washington barely got in. They're not very good. They're not even as good as the Islanders.
No, not by a long shot. I take the Islanders to probably win a series in five against the Caps.
Yeah, too bad they'll never meet because one's now definitely not advancing. But we do have to segue to the Islanders because of the Hurricanes, and the Hurricanes are the team that they're basically the wild card in this Eastern Conference contest because. They could win it all, and they could not win it all and fade out early. But I don't think the Islanders are going to get past them. The Islanders, as you keep saying, the Islanders aren't ready.
The Islanders still have time to go, but I will say that the Islanders are not a team that you want to sleep on in the playoffs, because as much as I say the old heads need to get off the team, well, the old heads are still here. They know how to play playoff hockey. They right. got a ton of guys that know how to play playoff hockey.
Deep playoff runs and very recently,
just,
yeah.
You simply, even if they're not the flashiest team or the best team, you simply don't want to play them, okay? If I'm so high on the Rangers and I think they can go all the way, still wouldn't want to play the Islanders first round. They're not a team you want to play in the playoffs. Regardless of if you 4-0 sweep them, they're probably going to beat you up while you're doing it. So I think when it comes down to it, the Islanders are not out of this series. Listen, that game was very, very close. Okay, I mean, it was 2-1 going into the third. It looks worse on paper because it's 3-1, but that third was an empty net goal that does not count. It does count, obviously, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't reflect how close that game actually was. So, you know, when you're looking at it down the stretch, that game, if that penalty in that first period doesn't happen, or if the Islanders can kill that off, they could very easily win it and take a game in Carolina. So the Islanders can still very much win this series.
If they do, then they're in obviously much better shape. We talk about it all the time. If you're the visiting team in the first two games and you split, that's in great shape.
Yeah. But I will say they're not out of this series. And the Hurricanes cannot count them out of this series. So I think if you're looking towards the second round, no matter who comes out of it, Islanders or Hurricanes, they're going to be in a lot more beaten up than the Rangers will be.
And if the Rangers, now I'm just trying to get the bracket down again, because if the Rangers do advance, they would get the winner of
Islanders-Hurricanes.
So you want this. You want the Islanders to beat the Hurricanes, because the Rangers and the Islanders have not faced each other in the playoffs since 94.
Yeah.
And the
Which Islanders, wasn't a great series either.
No, it was 1-8, and the Islanders got swept.
Yeah.
And the Islanders, they had gone to the conference finals the year before, but the Rangers were the team of destiny, despite what the Devils did to get in their way and took an overtime goal in Game 7 to finally get to the final, which meant that the Canucks were anticlimactic by comparison. But the fact is that, oh boy, yeah, I mean, here you are. You've never seen the Islanders and Rangers meet in the playoffs.
Nope, not in my life.
I grew up with it.
And, oh, that was the peak of hockey.
Yeah, I grew up with it. So, yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that you get to see this, because I'm going to be going crazy over it myself.
Yeah.
I do believe that the Rangers are a better team than the Islanders. There's no doubt about that.
Islanders have played them close every single game in the regular season, though.
Yes, that's also true. The Islanders do have certain aspects of the game that can keep them there, namely goaltending.
I think there might have been one game where the Rangers were outmatching the Islanders, but you think about the stadium series, you think about the games down the stretch, those were competitive games.
Yeah, although the Islanders' penalty kill left something to be desired in a stadium series game.
I mean, that usually does.
Yeah. But playoffs, everything changes. I expect a couple of overtime games, and you know what that means. You don't get out of the building till 2 o'clock in the morning, and they got to be wherever you need to be early the next day.
But not a lot of sleep.
Not a lot of sleep, but worth it. Playoff hockey and overtime, there is nothing better.
No. I love 5-on-5. 5-on-5 overtime. I mean, I think it creates some of the best moments, some of the best calls of all time as well, so it's definitely more than worth it.
Yeah, I've let's see, longest playoff game I've actually physically at, I think, is triple overtime.
That's two games for the price of one.
I think that was Islanders Caps in 93, believe it or not. I was actually there as a fan. But longest game I covered, definitely double. I've been to a couple few doubles, but I'm just trying to remember. But regardless, it's all in fun, and looking forward to what comes up next in the NHL playoffs, because
we can run down a few more games.
Yeah, let's do that.
Because of course we covered the local teams, which is the priority, unfortunately. And well, fortunately in my opinion, but unfortunately for potentially everyone who's listening,
because
Devils
you got great
did not
matchups.
Make it. Yeah.
You had Panthers Lightning, and now
that's a grudge match.
We voiced our concerns about if the Rangers were to face the Panthers in a future round, would they prevail? Well, nothing's guaranteed when you're facing the Tampa Bay Lightning, because talk about a team with experience.
Yep. again, the Lightning are a step up from the Islanders in the sense that you just never want to play them in the playoffs because they also have the skilled players on top of all the other players that they have. So, again, it's just it's a nightmare of a team to face off against, and I feel bad that the Panthers, you know, clinched their division and rewarded with the Lightning, but, you know, it is what it is. So, again, I have that series going to seven games in my predictions, and I have the Panthers taking it there, and so far I feel good with that.
Well, they did take the first one, and the Panthers basically did it by with defense. And Tampa Bay really got taken out of their game in that first one.
Yeah. Well, listen, and the fact that their power play was not clicking like it was in the regular season was a big factor as to why.
And they live
why.
And die by it.
They do. They live and die by special teams. Because not only is their power play the best in the league, their penalty kill is the best in the league. So
Yeah, 5-on-5 a little bit less so, but 5-on-5 is where the Panthers were able to excel on the forecheck.
Yeah. So, and as they should, as they absolutely should.
Okay, so game two will be at Florida on Tuesday. And again, you know, a lot of games are going on concurrently, and we'll try to watch as many as we can. But I believe Tuesday is the Islanders. Rangers play at home on Tuesday, so that's what we'll be concentrating on.
Yes, so Rangers play at home on Tuesday. Islanders play tomorrow, still away against the Hurricanes.
They are back in business on Wednesday at the UBS Arena. If I get this right.
Thursday,
okay.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a gap.
Right, yeah. One thing about playoff hockey, yes, they try to get it in every other day. And they also try to do the day after that. Yeah, because of other events. And, you know, the buildings try to accommodate it, especially if they know that the team is
likely to make playoffs.
Making the playoffs, they will accommodate it. But you never know. Every now and then, there might be a rock concert or the circus or some crazy thing in the way.
Especially at MSG.
Yes. MSG is one of the biggest, busiest buildings in the world. And, of course, the Knicks are playing, too.
Yep. And we'll get into that in a second. But first, I do want to run down the rest of the games because we do still have an hour here, Matt. So
we are approaching the 11 o'clock hour. WSB Stony Brook. This is the Sports Section. Matt Mankiewicz, Kevin Broderick here until midnight. 631-632-9872. 631-632-WSB. And yes, if the NHL isn't your fancy, you want to go back and touch on a topic we covered earlier, like the Stony Brook teams, you're more than welcome to do so. But call in and we'll see where we go from there. Okay, continuing on.
So we also have a classic matchup between the Maple Leafs and the Bruins.
Ah, yes.
And, of course, if anyone remembers anything about hockey, it is the fact that the Bruins have owned the Maple Leafs in the playoffs for a very long time. So, and that trend not changing in the first game, Bruins take it 5-1 in what was the least competitive game of the playoffs so far, and I will include the Capitals-Rangers game in that.
I'll tell you something. First of all, obviously the Bruins are coming into this thing with a chip on their shoulder because their early flame out last year.
Yeah.
Okay, so they definitely had something to prove. And the other thing, too, is that, yes, this is the ultimate rivalry in the NHL, contrary to what many people around here believe, is not Rangers-Islanders. It is Boston-Montreal.
Yeah.
But Boston-Toronto is not far behind.
No, not at all.
Because they're original six teams. But in the history of the NHL, going back 100-plus years, no two teams have faced each other more often than Boston and Montreal. Playoffs, regular season, the works. But, like I said, Toronto not far behind. Now, Toronto, we all know their story. And their story is...
Haven't won since 67.
And that was the last year of the original six era.
Yep.
So, since expansion, Toronto has not even gotten to a final. So...
They have never won three rounds.
Yeah, because they only had two rounds back in the original six.
Just to put that, they haven't won three rounds of playoff hockey.
By the way,
and they're an original six team.
In the original six era, because it was two rounds of playoffs, you had to win eight games to win the cup.
Which is the octopus thing.
Thank you very much.
Detroit Red Wings. If anyone's confused on why that happens, as I would assume a lot of people are, because Detroit doesn't really have a lot of other connections to an octopus. Squid.
No, it is an octopus.
It is an octopus? Okay.
Squid has 10 legs.
Okay. I got confused for a second. I thought I was having a...
Well, the
brain slip.
The NHL and also, you know, the arena operators have been trying to curtail that a little bit because used to be when somebody threw an octopus onto the ice, the ice keeper, so to speak, who came out to pick it up would wave it.
Yeah.
Now they're trying to